Okay, call this meeting the Audit Compliance and Title IX Committee to order. Can we have a roll call?
Chair Carter.
Here.
Chair Carter.
Vice Chair Perkins.
Here.
Regent Ariscotta.
Here.
Jim Geddes.
Here.
Jim McMichael.
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Fantastic. So we'll move on to item number one, public comment. Do we have any public comment here in Las Vegas? No, I don't think so. Do we have any public comment in Reno?
There's no public comment in Reno.
Very good. So we'll move on to item number two, consent items. Do I have a motion?
Move approval.
Second, Regent Perkins.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Aye. Motion carries unanimously. So we'll go on to item three, the chair's report. So we do have lots of stuff going on. Normally, we have our external audit report all finished back in December, but some of that folded over because of the CARES Act. So we have the rest of that piece today with us. We also have some other things that, because of legislation, we'll be working on, including the external audit, and look very much forward to working with LCB and seeing the results there. I don't think we have anything to hide, so it'll be interesting to get through that and get that going. And then we have the Title IX Task Force that will be coming up pretty soon. You'll hear more about that here in the very near future. At the end of today's meeting, or towards the end of today's meeting, we have our external auditor doing some development with us, and hopefully this is the first of several possible sessions that they'll be doing for us. I think that's all that I have for right now. So we'll move on to item number four, Foundation GBC, Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. In the audit summary document, I've included a table of reports being presented today along with our key observations. Before I get started, just again want to say thank you to the institutions with the reports being presented today. As I've noted, like a broken record at the last handful of meetings, we've been able to complete a majority of these audits in a remote fashion, taking advantage of our technology, increased collaboration with the institutions, and get these audits and follow-ups over the finish line. So thanks again. Some quick background on the first report being presented today. So as the committee knows, foundations are subject to separate financial statement audits by outside CPA firms, the results of which are typically shared at our December board meetings. So years ago, when we revamped our risk assessment process, it used to be heavily focused on financial risk. And since that financial review is performed annually by that outside firm, we didn't really have foundations on our radar. But with the revamp of our risk assessment process and considerations of other risks, operational, regulatory, reputation, to name a few, we felt it was worthwhile to take a look at some of these foundations and these entities with a slightly different lens. So to that end, I think we had some useful recommendations related to scholarship processes and those related key controls, as well as updates to policies and procedures to reflect what's really in line with current practice. Thanks.
Were there any questions about the GBC Foundation audit from the committee members? There's some good stuff, some good recommendations for getting some policies and procedure guidelines, in place in there. And that's one of the things I've tried to push the audit committee to do is go beyond just numbers and looking at policies and procedures and best practices and trying to help our institutional units, better themselves through some of these things. So I would entertain a motion to accept the Foundation GBC
audit.
Motion to approve. Motion to approve from Regent McMichael. Do I have a second?
Regent Perkins.
Regent Perkins, a second. Any more discussion or questions? Hearing and seeing none, all in favor of accepting the report, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. We'll move on to item number five, Facilities Management, WNC. Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. This audit is another example, as you might imagine, with something like facilities where, there's a physical observation and presence necessary at times. So that creates some difficulties when trying to do this during a pandemic. But again, WNC was very helpful and patient with us as we work through our audit procedures. So just very quick takeaways from the report. Noted some opportunities for control improvements surrounding expenditures, things that we've seen before, like splitting of transactions, as well as documentation of inventory procedures and contract reviews. Thank you.
Any questions or comments for Mr. Sunbury about the audit? I'll just comment. Anytime there's a split transaction that comes across on the audit, I always point that out. You know, there are cap limits on the spending cards that our employees have, and they're there for a reason. So we don't want to have those splits, happening. I would accept the motion for the approval of the Facilities Management WNC audit.
Motion to approve.
Motion to approve, Regent Michael.
Second.
Second from Regent Perkins. Any further questions or discussion? Hearing and seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We'll move on to item number 6, hosting UNR, Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. The Board of Regents handbook requires that internal audit tests host expenses annually. So the way we've satisfied that historically is to sample a given institution or two annually and do that on a rotating basis. So the one thing I'll say is for as deep of a dive as these reviews can often be, this really is more of an audit pamphlet rather than an audit report. There's just a couple of items noted with opportunities to improve on documentation or monitoring. So thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Sunbury? Hearing and seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to accept the hosting UNR audit.
Motion to approve.
Motion to approve from Regent McMichael. Second from Regent Perkins. Any further questions or discussion? Hearing and seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. On to item number 7, internal audit compliance and Title IX updates. Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, again, Joe Sunbury. We introduced this section as sort of a standing item to be able to provide some departmental updates and, more importantly, have that placeholder to discuss anything really within the purview of this committee. So in the past, I've used this platform to update the committee on financial aid-related findings, something you'll hear our external auditors talk about in a little bit, walk through our updated risk assessment methodologies, and speak about work that internal audit was doing related to other board initiatives. So today, this will be brief, because I know we have our external auditors in the virtual waiting room, and everybody's excited about that. But I think, and one thing I legitimately am excited about is, you know, coordinating with Grant Thornton's advisory services group. I think the workshop today, I know it'll be lengthy, but I promise it will be fascinating for the committee, and I know that'll take up the balance of the meeting, so I'll work quickly here. For internal audit, at the last meeting, I mentioned internal audit's QAR, and that's our quality assurance review. And this is sort of our version of who audits the auditors. And we have just about completed our self-review. And in early August, we've coordinated our independent validation of that review, which I'm hopeful will yield some useful improvements. Obviously, we always aim to be in line with our professional standards, but want to use this as an opportunity to elevate our performance wherever we can. So based on the timing of when that independent validation will occur, I expect to provide this committee with a full report along with that independent review and that whatever related deliverable comes with it for our December meeting. On the compliance front, those of you who were on the committee last June may recall that at this meeting in 2020, I was able to provide a very, for lack of a better word, pretty colorful graph with some national benchmarking information that the company that administers our hotline provides. So last year, we had received that report in late April, which created some natural reporting metrics and buckets. Unfortunately, this year, we received that report in late May. So my team will perform that analysis, and I'll provide that deeper detail and benchmark during our next meeting in September. But briefly, based on our last full quarter of information, I can say that our hotline volume is down a tick, which is actually consistent with the trend we've seen throughout the pandemic. And again, while I haven't dug into the details of the benchmarking report, I can tell you that literally the first bullet point of the first item in the executive summary they provide mentions that report volumes have decreased essentially nationwide. So again, we'll dig into those details, provide those metrics at our next meeting, but we continue to monitor and track those compliance items. And then the last prepared remark I have very quickly for Title IX, it's a timely update pursuant to Chief General Counsel Reynolds. The U.S. Department of Education is conducting hearings this week regarding the new Title IX regulations that became effective in 2020 and is currently soliciting live and written comments. So NSHE will be submitting written comments urging the Department of Education to amend and or repeal provisions of the newly enacted regulations. Chief General Counsel Reynolds continues to work with the Nevada Attorney General's Office on the multi-state litigation challenging the new regulations as well. So that concludes my prepared comments. Happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Are there any questions for Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury? Well, I'll add a little something. So it is a neat process, and he can probably elaborate a little bit more on this. So we do have internal audit, and then who validates internal audit? Well, there's an external audit process, and I don't know if it's this group. You can clarify, Mr. Sunbury. And essentially, chief internal auditors from other institutions agreed to be that validation for a different system, and then at some point, Mr. Sunbury will validate another systems or business's internal audit function. Can you say it in the right way?
Sure, no. So as part of the, Joe Sunbury for the record, as part of the Association of College and University Auditors, I am part of a group that essentially will, yes, eventually have my turn to validate another group against our standards and IIA professional standards. So by volunteering that time, that allows us to have this independent validation done at the vast cost of $0. So,
thank you. Any further questions for? No? Okay. Seeing and hearing none, we'll move on to item number 8, communication with those charged with governance, NSHE. And this will be Kim McCormick from Grant Thornton.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Kim McCormick with Grant Thornton, happy to be with you all today. As we dive into agenda item number 8, for those of you following along in your reference material, you may want to pull up page 7 of 16, because I think it's a good summary of what I will be sharing with you as we report out on the what's really part 2 of Nevada System of Higher Education's annual audit. For those of you who will recall, we reported out on audit results for the financial statement audit back in the December meeting. The second part of the audit, which is what's called the Uniform Guidance Federal Compliance Audit, was put on pause because of some new awards that came out of the CARES Act and some delay in the Office of Management and Budget actually putting together the audit guide that they would like external auditors like us to follow. So once that came out, we were able to complete that audit, and with the goal today is to report out to you all on the results of that audit. So just to give you a frame of reference, between all the institutions in Nevada System of Higher Education, the combined organizations administer roughly $600 million of federal awards a year. Some of those are awards that end up going to students in the form of student financial aid, some of it's research and development money, and other programmatic initiatives. Which particular awards are subject to an audit in a given year is a subject of the formula that the Office of Management and Budget provides to the external auditor. So if you do have page 7 of 16 open, you'll see that there are 4 programs that met the threshold to be audited for fiscal 20. And so you'll see here a good sense of the magnitude of each of those programs in the context of the whole $600 million and what the audit results were. The first program that was audited is Department of Education Student Financial Assistance Cluster. This is a very large program, and it tends to meet the criteria to be audited each year. So 2020 was no different. The ultimate result of that audit is that there were seven findings that were reported, some matters of internal control and some matters of non-compliance. Our opinions with respect to that particular program were qualified for two instances of non-compliance. The first in a category called the Gram-Leach-Bliley Act, which has to do with the need to do a certain risk assessment for student information security. And the second in the category of return of Title IV, which are some very specific rules about how much aid a student has to return when they withdraw midterm. So all of those findings are outlined in our next agenda item document. So I'll point out to you where those are. But the good news is that the number of overall findings for student financial aid did decrease from the prior year. And while some of the findings were repeat issues, overall, the trend is continuing to go in the right direction there. So that's a student financial assistance cluster. The next program is also a Department of Education program called the TRIO cluster. This audit went very well, an unmodified opinion or a clean opinion, and there were no findings associated with the audit. The third is a health and human services program called the Opioid State Targeted Response Program. This was a new one that we had not audited before. It met the threshold for 2020. 100% of this program is administered at University of Nevada, Reno. This audit also went very well, an unmodified clean opinion and no findings reported. So those are what I would categorize as the traditional type of federal programs that we looked at for 2020. The new program that came out of last March's CARES Act is the Education Stabilization Fund, Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund that you may be familiar with. This is a portion of the first tranche of monies that came to Nevada system as a result of that program, $38 million for 2020. So our opinion on this audit was also unmodified, a clean opinion. There were three internal control findings that we reported, and those are outlined in agenda number 9 that I'll point out in a moment. One thing I will say about this new program, because it's new, and because the rules for this program kind of unfolded and emerged as you spent. It's one of these cases where sometimes you get the money, then they tell you later how you're supposed to use it. I thought the audit results were very good. I mean, to only have three findings coming out of a brand new program where the rules were somewhat of a moving target, what was a really good result. So congratulations to you all for that. So Regent Carter, that is really the highlight of agenda item number 8. Happy to answer any questions from the committee members.
Any questions, or are you ready to go to item number 9 where we kind of get a little more in depth? Seeing and hearing none, that was information only item, so we'll go to item number 9 where we go a little bit more in depth into that audit.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Kim McCormick with Grant Thornton for the record. For agenda item number 9, your reference material is a very big document. Just to give you some context and to know where to look, specific to the findings, you might want to pull up page 199 of 242. That's where the findings that I just mentioned are outlined. What this document represents in the aggregate is the results of the financial statement audit that we talked about back in December and these four uniform guidance audits. Yeah, the bulk of the document is the actual financial statement that Nevada System has prepared, and this entire document, which includes the findings and also management's responses and corrective action plan specific to these findings, is the formal document that gets submitted to the U.S. government. In fact, that was sent electronically earlier this week to the U.S. government. So on page 199, start the individual findings that I reported to you a moment ago. The findings start with the student financial assistance cluster and the handful of findings associated with the new CARES Act money are at the end. I did not plan to go over each in detail, but I would rather Regent Carter see if there's any questions of the committee members about any of the findings in particular.
I'll start us off. So the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act was something that we have been aware of for quite a while, and it was a finding that we had last year. And really the only threshold at that point was just having a plan, not really even a good plan, just having a plan. And some of our institutions didn't have that. So, and Mr. Sunberg, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe in March we actually brought that item back to kind of repoint out the importance of that being done. And that was one of the repeat findings this year. One of the institutions did not finish that plan. I don't know if you want to add a little more to that, Mr. Sunberry or Ms. McCormick.
Joe Sunberry, for the record. You're correct, Regent Carter. I think when this item came up, this committee identified which institutions had that finding, and those institutions kind of provided an interim update, kind of almost like a six-month follow-up like we do for our internal audit findings. And I do know in speaking with a couple of the institutions, some of them had performed and even outsourced comprehensive reviews, but unfortunately fell just short of that threshold to sort of, it's a very much a pass-fail control, right? You either kind of did the risk assessment or you didn't, and unfortunately they fell just short of that. So, thanks.
Mr. Heavey, did you want to add anything onto that?
Sure. This is something that we are aware of, and we had performed a gap analysis at UNLV. Chris Heavey, for the record, provost at UNLV, and we were surprised to find that the gap analysis was not deemed appropriate for the full risk assessment that was needed, but we've taken additional steps now to make sure that we are actively completing that risk assessment. We have an executive team working to make sure that we are putting in place all of the controls that will be necessary to be compliant with this going forward.
Very good. I just don't want to see it next year. So just, I mean, you're well aware of it now. Everybody knows you've gotten the two, shots at it. So let's just make sure it's fixed for next year. The other one that occasionally comes up, and I think this may have been from a different institution in the previous audit, but was return of funds, lack of timeliness. I mean, Ms. McCormick, maybe you could just kind of tell us what that means first, and then if anybody wants to add anything.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Kim McCormick with Grant Thornton for the record. So those of you following along in your materials, we're on page 202 of 242, and this is finding 2020-002. The student financial aid administrative rules are quite complex, and there are a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross with respect to administering this program. One of the most complex areas kicks in when a student who participates in the student financial aid program withdraws midterm, and there is a complex calculation that needs to be that takes place to determine if the student returns some of their aid to Department of Education and what portion of it they keep. The rules around that calculation are very complex, and there are very strict timelines for when that calculation has to be done and when the return amount needs to be returned and reported to the government. And so we do a fair amount of sampling of students in this area, and this is an area that is a repeat finding for several years, but this year the level of exception did tick up, particularly when it came to the timing issue and then a number of other specific calculation issues. Just to give you a frame of reference, when we do pull samples at schools, our sample size is typically about 60, and on the timing issue, 41 of those 60 students in the sample ended up being errors for the timing issue, the calculation being done on time and the funds being returned on time. So that was a very high rate of exception. And so when I say that the magnitude of this one ticked up this year, that was one of the key contributors.
Were there any follow-up comments from UNLV?
Chair Carter, this is Provost TV again. I do want to say that we absolutely recognize the seriousness of these concerns. And I would say that this has been the number one action item that President Whitfield and I have been working on since our time together. We have dramatically changed pretty much everything about our financial aid office, including putting in new leadership, new processes, new trainings, and new certifications, so that in the future we are handling, as Ms. McCormick said, this is a complex matter, but it's been clear that we didn't have adequate controls or training of the staff who were doing this work, and we have made changes at all levels of those processes. This period ended June 30th, 2020. We may have some findings from the period before we put these changes in place, but we commit that 2 years from now we will have dramatically improved audits, and next year we should have a substantially improved audit. And as I said, it's been a prime focus of President Whitfield and mine to improve the accuracy of the work in this office.
Very good. Are there questions for Ms. McCormick or Sunbury or for UNLV from anybody on the committee or anybody off the committee? Seeing and hearing no questions, I would entertain a motion to accept our audit.
Motion to accept.
Motion to accept from Regent Michael. Second from Regent Perkins. Any other questions or discussion? Hearing and seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. So we're on to item number 10. So when we entered into the last agreement with Grant Thornton, we realized that they offer a lot of different training and things, and we hadn't really availed ourselves of that training in the past. So this is kind of the first training that they're going to conduct for us. I believe Matt, is it Unterman? Hopefully I got the name right, is on virtually with us. We'll see if he's here.
I'm here.
There we are. Fantastic. You can take it away. It's all yours.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Matt Unterman with Grant Thornton. I believe we have slides that will go on screen. Wonderful. So it's always nice to start a presentation with the Chief and General Auditor saying, you're excited, you'll find this fascinating. I hope I hit the bar that's been established here. The agenda lists this as a informational only presentation. And before getting into introducing myself and what I'll be covering, I would just encourage Chair Carter and the committee. There's a lot of content I can certainly present at for 45 minutes. If there's a desire to have a dialogue, we can stop it anyway and carry the remainder of the presentation on at another time. As Chair Carter mentioned, my name is Matt Unterman. Next slide, please. I lead Grant Thornton's not-for-profit and higher education advisory services for the firm. I've been with Grant Thornton for over 15 years, and I'm a partner in the practice. As Chair Carter mentioned, we do much more than auditing and tax services at the firm. We also have a very comprehensive consulting practice. I'm here today not to sell those services or whatnot, but just to talk about what we're seeing in the industry. It's certainly an exciting time, a challenging time. The last year in particular has been particularly challenging in higher education. And what we've done today is put together a, I would call it a survey presentation of the many, many trends that we're seeing in higher education pre-COVID, during the pandemic, and our predictions for the future. And either today or at a subsequent meeting, we'd love to have a dialogue on these topics. Next slide, please. There's a lot to cover, a big agenda. Probably 45 minutes is not adequate. As I've mentioned, I'm planning to take a fairly quick pace through all of these topics, if you can believe it, in 45 minutes. Let's call it a survey course of the many things that are happening in higher education. Again, along the way, if you'd like to pause and we can talk about any one of these things, that's great. We can certainly continue the remainder of the agenda at a subsequent conversation, or I will proceed to just carry through the bulk of this and maybe next time we'll have a conversation. Next slide, please. So we'll start with the higher education COVID-19 update. Next slide, please. Obviously, we've all been through the past 14 to 15 months. We've lived this together. Certainly, it's been an interesting journey and a challenging one. The reason why we're starting on a COVID timeline is obviously this has been truly on our minds in higher education for the past year plus. But what's particularly interesting about the pandemic is we see that as it accelerated and exacerbated a number of trends that were already existing within the higher education industry. And I'll be covering some of those on the subsequent slides. Just taking you through the kind of timeline trajectory that we've experienced and probably you've experienced over this past period. Obviously, last year, rolling back the clock 12 to 14 months, the spring, summer, there was a sense of hope versus no, a sense of we hope this is done quickly. In our hearts, we probably knew it may not be done quickly. In fact, we're still seeing it not yet complete. And we saw across the higher education landscape true variability in preparation, which of course led towards in fall 2020, a return to campus, which it went. Sometimes it went well depending on the campus, and sometimes it met with challenges. But what I certainly was pleased to see, all the responses across the higher education landscape. And along the way, the last bullet in fall 2020 as a column, I think what's interesting is, although this is certainly not the year that any of us would have chosen, there were silver linings, particularly silver linings that allowed us as institutions across the United States to look at our sacred cows, to examine ourselves, to seek what was true to serve our missions, to seek what was true to serve our students and allow our faculty to teach and to serve our communities. And some things that were not as core were put off to the side, unfortunately. It provides us an opportunity as we head into the fall of 21 and the future to think about how to reconstitute ourselves and project towards the future. Obviously, we're in summer 2021, where we are now, we're looking to return to campus part two, and many institutions across the United States have been deciding to progressively invest in that future through enhanced enterprise risk management, flipping enterprise systems, ERP and whatnot, doing cost of education modeling, and just generally speaking, positioning for the future as they see consumer preferences have changed and there are opportunities to seize within the market. Obviously, in the last column beyond this fall, what's true, of course, is the fall of 19 was a bit of an anomaly, to say the least. The fall of 2020 was an anomaly, to say the least. The fall of 2021 is still that anomaly. And what is certainly true is the fall of 19 will be markedly different than the fall of 22 and the fall of 2023. And the question is how. We know preferences have changed. We know catchment areas of incoming students have changed. We are frankly not certain across the industry as to what will stick from this last period. What is clear is there's an opportunity for institutions that are seeking to position themselves in the future, think about changing their model pedagogically, geographically, in many ways to serve their constituents and reposition themselves and really reimagine themselves. And PS, of course, beyond, there's still this enrollment cliff that we're facing. And we have a question about how might we continue on the journey of various things that we sought to do from the beginning, such as providing access to students that did not have traditional access to education or equitable outcomes for those that are admitted. Next slide, please. So COVID was an interesting journey, period. It was a challenging year, period. But what's very interesting is it allowed us to see kind of our future. It allows us to see the opportunities that present themselves and, of course, the challenges that we have to still deal with. Next slide, please. Creating sustainable future, we're going to be covering effectively through this entire presentation. We'll be picking articles out from our recently published State of Higher Education publication, which has just recently been published in March. And all these articles are there, and I think we're going to give a survey course towards some of those articles over this presentation. So the first one, just to pause and indulge me for a couple of minutes, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. Next slide, please. And next slide, please. This article opens our current publication, and in fact, it gives us a chance to step back from our day-to-day within higher education and step back towards we've learned a lot from ourselves, we've learned a lot from each other, and now it's time to actually try to steal a card from the for-profit playbook, the commercial playbook, and think about, is there something to learn beyond the industry? Obviously, we respect the industry, we respect the mission service, but maybe there's some things we can consider as we determine the future trajectory. Next slide, please. A few of these are on the slide, and I won't cover all of them in interest of time. The first one, I'll use the term, which is probably not usually utilized within the higher education landscape, customer. It's all about the customer. Obviously, it's all about our students. It's all about our stakeholders. It's all about our faculty. It's all about our communities. But the concept within this article that we've mentioned is taking a customer-focused mindset towards serving a mission. There are a number of ways that we can determine are our consumers, are our students' needs fully met, are our communities' needs fully met. And taking that for-profit mindset provides us some opportunities for true customer service. What's in your portfolio? What we saw in the for-profit landscape is drastically trimming of offerings and products and services during this period to look at those that are most, dare I say, profitable. Obviously, I only serve higher education institutions and nonprofits, so I use these terms very intentionally in this careful space to say, think about how this may allow us to think about what we're providing in our higher education institutions to serve our mission. Have we optimized our portfolio? Have we looked at what serves our constituents? What, dare I say, makes margin? What doesn't? And looking at that collection as a whole. Partnering to serve is the last one here. Thinking about, from a commercial standpoint, there are many, many things that happened over the last 12 to 14 months. Even in the commercial industry, the research and launching of the COVID vaccines was done through partnership. Thinking of ourselves being able to steal a page from the for-profit playbook there, what are we doing to partner today? What are the things that we're best to do internally? What are the opportunities that we can leverage others to extend our mission service? Next slide, please. Market to grow. Sometimes in higher ed, we shy away from the term marketing or outreach. In reality, there's a significant opportunity here. Public higher education in particular, many institutions actually saw increase in their enrollment over this COVID time period. Maybe not an increase in their enrollment-related revenues, but an increase in enrollment, and thinking about ways to capitalize that and increase our catchment areas to extend our service. Going in line, of course, happened by force, but we can steal a page from the for-profit playbook in terms of the true leveraging of the online portfolio. The question is, consumer preferences have changed to a degree. There is obviously still a preference in some for an on-premise education, but how can we capitalize on the hybrid modality to potentially increase our volumes at institutions? Thinking about ways to leverage on-premise, online, and hybrid to serve even more in the way that they would like to be served. Silver linings, I've already mentioned that, and truly the presentation here is about investing in your future and thinking of this really challenging time as an inflection point for going forward. Next slide, please. Charting a future course, a new operating model, that cues this up, okay? And next slide, please. I'll probably be saying next slide, please, quite a lot. There's a number of slides and covering a lot of content. I apologize for that. So charting a future course, a new operating model. This article talks about just the many changes that are happening in higher education and probably should or could happen in higher education. I'll just focus on the last bullet here. There are a number of challenges that exist today, opportunities, but it really is all about serving your mission. Next slide, please. And it's all about creating a path to sustainability, financial sustainability to serve your mission. There are challenges that happened in the past. As I mentioned, pre-COVID, we all recall there were challenges in terms of these trends. And going forward, there will continue to be challenges in terms of enrollment, financial sustainability, increasing expenses, and trying to serve our students and our missions in this restricted financial environment. Next slide, please. In fact, it is the current model that I think we can look at within higher education that is truly a bit of a limitation. We have large multi-campus institutions that are resource intensive, clearly serving a certain economy of scale, but really bursting at the seams in terms of the need for revitalization of facilities and investment in facilities, that high level of capital and operational funding that's required to serve in highly tuition dependent organizations. Of course, this is all in the context of falling enrollment in pockets of the United States and in amidst this complex and expensive ecosystem of facilities that we keep up to date. Next slide, please. And the challenges to address also include, obviously, seeking to continue doing bottom line cost reduction, top line growth. And as I mentioned at the beginning, acknowledging that there's still room to grow in terms of how we as higher education institutions serve access, provide access. And for those that do have access, to achieve equitable outcomes for those that are enrolled in our institutions. Next slide, please. The path to the future, in a lot of ways, we're covering many topics here today. And while some of these may be familiar to some of you, hopefully that some of this will stimulate some conversation about thinking about ways to shift the model, to build upon our model, our very successful mission delivery in the past, and thinking about ways to modify for going forward to increased mission delivery, looking at not just our traditional 18 to 22 year old college educated students, but also adult learners or competency based students, those that may not be seeking degrees, but seek education in some way, shape or form. So I think one thing that we see in the higher education industry is we call ourselves the higher education industry. But in reality, we are in the education industry and thinking about ourselves as post-secondary institutions and the opportunity to serve the educational needs of our communities and thinking about how we've been doing that today up to this point, and how we could potentially do that going forward. Next slide, please. This, of course, looks at not just back office consolidation and expense reduction, but also looking at revenue enhancement, looking at existing sources of revenue through improved consumer, customer, and student retention, but also looking at revenue from new sources, new markets, existing markets, geographies that we might not have covered well today, or offerings or products that we may not have covered today, including non-degree granting, our products and services. Next slide, please. In fact, what we're seeing, and this is probably rolling ahead many, many years, is kind of imagining a future with national universities. Obviously, we're far from that, and we're not predicting that anytime soon. But if you think about the consolidation that's happened outside of the higher education industry, practically in every industry towards national consolidation, we see this happening to a degree within higher education. The emergence of massive online universities and those that serve tens of thousands or over 100,000 students online. And we're looking at kind of a consolidation in a way from behind the scenes and an opportunity for us to think about ourselves, not just serving our current catchment areas and geographies, but beyond. So next slide, please. So hopefully this gives you a sense for the things that we are thinking about as a practice and our clients are thinking about in terms of how they position themselves within the higher education landscape. This next section, budgeting transformation in higher education, next slide, please, is actually illustrative of all those things that are being considered. So what's happened, of course, over the last 12 to 14 months is just massive revision and revisiting and over of our budgets. And in reality, why has that happened? Obviously, there's a significant inflection point in the loss of revenues. That's, of course, what happened in an increase of expenses to respond to COVID. But next slide, please. But what also has happened is really a revisioning and questioning of the inputs into our model in a way that hasn't happened in decades. If you could look at this quick drawing here, there's three columns: external demand, academic value generation, institutional impact and achievement. And I would say what's happened in the last 14 months is more dramatic in these columns than happened in the prior 14 years, times two or three if you want. External demand, what's happened is we have changing consumer preferences, an opportunity to look at catchment areas, an opportunity to think about market needs and consumer preferences to degrees in the area of degree grants. And it gives us an opportunity to think about ourselves and how we're positioned to capture a portion of this market. What is our brand? What is not our brand? How are we positioned? What students come in? How do we serve them? Into the second column, academic value generation. What resources are we putting towards pedagogical and student support services to serve those incoming students? What is our current student volume and mix? Should or could that be changed? How are we resourcing those students through the academic value generation engine, which is our degree granting institution? And out the other side is what impact and achievement are we looking to achieve? Clearly mission, always mission. You can go back one slide, please. Clearly mission, one, but also now financial performance. We're seeing an increasing amount of institutions look at margin and course by program through cost of revenue analytics and cost of education modeling and market positioning, which of course feeds back into the first column as a loop. So these three columns have dramatically changed and will continue to dramatically change. And it's for institutions to think about how they would like to pursue each of these columns going into the future. And that will, of course, continue to modify your budget modification process. So just a couple quick slides, next slide, please, in terms of what this done over this past period. This has become an iterative mindset, almost a rolling forecast type of approach in terms of the budgets over the last period. The question is that beneficial for going forward? In the past, we had what I would say, an incremental budgeting, a small change kind of budgeting mindset. This last 12 to 14 months has allowed us to really think about this as truly an opportunity to think about what allocations should we do on a going forward basis? What is our core? We've almost been stripped to a zero-based budgeting mindset, and adding back budget is a question for going forward. Adding it all back right then and there may not be the right mission-driven approach. Next slide, please. So cost and revenue modeling, I've talked about this a couple of times, and what is it? Cost and revenue modeling, next slide, please, is talking about ways to take all your data and think about what is the true cost or margin, what is the revenue for each university, school, major programs down to the course level. By many, this is considered kind of almost a four-letter word. You know, we're not allowed to think about one course makes money and one course loses money. In fact, the reality is that happens with every industry, every company throughout the world. Some products make money, some products lose money. And in higher education, that's been the case. What we haven't been doing well historically is to give transparency to this and have intentionality to it. We think some courses make money when in reality they don't, and vice versa. Next slide, please. What are the benefits? The benefits are allowing to us to make real-time decision-making on how do we allocate our courses, how do we channel our students, what courses we would like to invest in. We need to, of course, do this very carefully with a change management approach to bring our communities along, not just kind of force this upon anyone, given the new mindset. Next slide, please. What's very interesting about cost and revenue modeling and the cost of education modeling is it allows us to break from the framework of adding resources increases quality and increases quantity. In reality, sometimes that just increases resources. To think about how we can better allocate resources to our mission, I'll just tell a quick story. So we've been doing this with a number of institutions, and it was very interesting as we work with this public institution. They discovered that they were actually making margin off a course, but that course, that program was not only a positive margin program. This was an institution that served many students in need. In reality, it was serving their needs very significantly, allowing them to transform their lives and truly get the education that they required. And it was a series of programs and courses that the faculty truly enjoyed teaching. So there's a triple win here of they decided that this is actually where they made money, dare I say, and they're able to actually transform their organization and better serve their mission by doubling down in this area. Many other stories here, but effectively what's very interesting in the cost and revenue modeling is to take those models and to transform the organization and investments as a result. Covering a lot of ground, sorry for the speed. Certainly stop me if anyone would like to discuss. Next slide, please, on reserves planning. Reserves planning, I'll skip to the next slide, please. Operating reserves, what are our reserves? A lot of questions. How do you define a reserve? How much should I have in my reserves? Why are those reserves there? Is that amount defensible? What happens when that reserve amount comes under attack? How do I make sure to give rationality to my board, to my regents, to the public when they question the reserve levels? Next slide, please. What's happened, of course, is there's been traditional approaches to reserves planning to think about number of operating months operating expense the liquid net assets as a percent of budget. There's all these kind of rules of thumb, but the one size fits all approach doesn't work for reserves. It doesn't work for you all as institutions. It probably doesn't even work across within your institutions. The reality is everyone is in a unique position. Everyone has unique risks. Everyone has unique opportunities. So we all need to think about reserves, especially what's been happening over the past year, in a very unique way. So next slide, please.
Sorry, our approach this is Chair Carter. Is there an existing study or recommendation or consulting on reserve funding? Or how would Grant Thornton be able to help us learn about what's an appropriate reserve as we, you know, work with the legislature on kind of figuring out what that looks like?
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Matt Unterman with Grant Thornton. In response, what's on screen is very much what we believe is an opportunity to think about this across the higher education landscape, is to pool reserves into three buckets. Pardon the informality of the term. A risk reserves pool, a general reserves pool, and a working capital pool. In fact, we do have a white paper on this that can be shared. And thinking about that risk reserves pool in a probabilistic, true calculation manner, to think about what risks may occur to you and how to apply the impact and percent of our opportunity that results from those reserves. And to think about the general reserves as money that you can put aside to truly fulfill future obligations in a strategic manner. And to think about these as three pools that serve three different purposes, scientifically derived to allow you to kind of make strategic decisions. And Chair Carter, if you'd like to have a conversation on this or to see the white paper, we'd be more than happy to do so. Next slide, please. Covering a lot of ground in my survey course of higher education here. So next slide, please. Tailoring fundraising to generational nuances. I'll go through this section rather quickly. The whole idea here, there's many revenue streams in higher education. One of them, of course, is fundraising, and messaging is really important from a generational perspective. What we've seen is that there's limited tailoring or not as much tailoring towards generational differences in terms of fundraising. An opportunity within higher education and beyond within nonprofits and frankly, in communication within for-profits to make sure that the messaging comes across appropriately. So next slide, please. Next slide, please. I'll just give you a quick snapshot into next slide, please. Perfect. Just looking at four generations at a very high level, kind of a quick bubble up of various differences. It's important to realize that how we communicate with one generation needs to be different than how we communicate with another generation. Some are more transactional, some are more recurring, some want to see the results, some are more online, some are more offline. Many higher education institutions have tapped into this, many have not. This is an opportunity, given the challenges that we've had over the past year, to think about ways that we message to try and prop up our base. Next slide, please. Rounding out the section, M&A. This is mergers, partnerships, and collaboration. Next slide, please. A year ago, there were countless articles about how the COVID was going to be the downfall of a higher education industry. It was going to result in massive consolidations and mergers. In fact, some have happened, and the trend is there. It's a slow trend. What we're seeing in higher education and in nonprofits is an increased willingness to consider this. We've seen this, of course, some examples within public higher education, private higher education. And we just thought it would be remiss in excluding this section here. It's a trend that was happening pre-COVID. The challenges in COVID have certainly increased this trend to a degree. Next slide, please. But in reality, while it's at an all-time high, we're still seeing a limited amount. But it's important for us to think about across our state to say, are there opportunities for us, next slide, please, to think about, are there institutions that are struggling that we can expand our footprint? Are there institutions that we can partner with to better serve our mission? What's happened, of course, in the right-hand side is a concern. Really, the main issue in higher education is a sense of identity. Who have we been to our core since our founding? How do our alumni experience us? What is our brand in the market? And identity is truly critical to many higher education institutions and their full set of stakeholders, resisting this likely leaning in this direction. So we have a concept at Grant Thornton and what we've seen in the market of a synthetic merger, which is actually in the commercial side, not just within higher ed, but the idea of merging organizations but consolidating back office, keeping the front brand to the market, allowing alumni to see the brand they've always known, but allowing there to be some back office consolidation and economies of scale on the back end. But it's not just about the back end. It's about driving to the mission the opportunity to provide our courses in other locations, the opportunity for them to cross-pollinate their courses with others, right? So we've seen this happen some over this last period. We, of course, in terms of the government funding that's exists to prop a number of institutions up, has not happened as much as it would have else. But in reality, we are going to look to this fall in next year. As I said, the fall of 22 and 23 will look very different than the fall of 19. We anticipate updating you and seeing how this trend continues over the coming periods. Next section, please. Next slide, please. So we've covered a lot of ground. This last section was about creating a sustainable future. And these next two sections are going to pivot a little bit. One is technology, and the other is supporting the campus community. I'm going to go to next slide, please. This next section is about OPMs, online program management. OPM, next slide, please, is about taking universities online. You all have gone in this direction over the last year. Everyone has gone in this direction over the last year. But I would say online education has not been necessarily a success, except in a binary sense, pardon the pun for those computer science folks out there. So the idea is we are online, but are we maximizing the online pedagogical platform? Are we truly serving our students in the online in the online world? Are we reaching economies of scale, or do we, pardon the phrase, just throw our courses online and call that a success? In reality, our consumers were thrilled that they could continue their coursework last spring and summer in an online manner. In reality, their preferences have gotten more mature, and they're become more and more discerning, both our 18 to 22 year old traditional students, but also the adult learners and the alternatives that they have in the market. So many have gone the OPM route to make sure the platforms are stable and an opportunity to partner from a third party perspective. This is just something to make you aware of in terms of the overall online world and what many institutions have truly thought about in terms of up their game from a technological perspective. Next slide, please. Advantages, of course, is rapid implementation, wider consumption, and thinking about financial investment in a different manner than what if we have to be deployed to truly do this in an effective manner on one's own. Next slide, please. So I'll pause. Oh, sorry, here, lost a slide. So of course, there's some things to consider on both sides. Is this for us? Is this not for us? The reds and the greens you can probably decipher. But basically thinking about, is this a right fit for us per institution and across the system? Next slide, please. So as you can tell, I'm talking about things that are trending, things that are cutting edge, things that are happening in the last 6 to 12 to 18 months, not things that are tried and true. I haven't talked about the importance of ERPs and changing our ERP systems. I haven't talked about all the tried and true, I would call it motherhood and apple pie topics that come up time and time again. But this is the things, this large set, frankly, it's exciting time within higher ed. And one of the things is data and analytics. Next slide, please. So data analytics is truly at the cutting edge within higher education. And what we're seeing there is the better leveraging of systems to look at data and drive mission value and financial value. We're not yet at maturity, I wouldn't say, across the institutions in this realm, but we certainly are at a place where we've achieved a lot of ground. And what's, of course, challenging about data analytics is there's just a lot of data. Understatement. There's a lot of data and what to do with the data and how to dissect the data, especially given our limited resources at our institutions to slice and dice. And there's many things to do with it. There's program costing, there's linking financials and geos, there's preventing fraud and identifying issues of non-compliance. It could be used in a variety of ways. Next slide, please. Having a sophisticated, really data analytics program is what's required to provide program impact. To really demonstrate program impact. It's not just about the collecting of data, it's not just about analyzing the data, it's about truly transforming your organization and serving your constituents. There's a continuum there. Next slide, please. So what I would like to say, you have the data, which is not information, which is not analytics, which is not transformation. So the idea of data analytics, it needs to go across the entire continuum to truly transform your organization, which is what it's really about. Many institutions we're seeing have these data analytics programs. I'm very proud of the analysis they do. But we have presented in higher education forums and we said, who has a data analytics program? And the hands are raised. Who has truly transformed their organization with that data and the analytics? The hands go down. And thinking about this, a true opportunity to serve our financial situation, serve our mission, serve our students, serve our institutions, serve our faculty by thinking about the wealth of data that we already have at our fingertips and to really think about using this technologically. Next slide, please. Last topic in the technology piece is AI, artificial intelligence. Next slide, please. We've heard a lot about data analytics. Now we're into AI, and probably we've heard about AI in terms of robotics, robotic process automation, or RPA. Many institutions are using this to transform their back offices, to enable them to automate processes that would previously have to be manual, to think about fundraising, to think about identifying the donors that are best to target and how to best do outreach, to really automate things at scale that we'd have to really deploy armies to get ahead of. Academically, this could be used to help identify students that are at risk, students to retain them, opportunities to reach out at key points in their pathways. Next slide, please. So, and it's not, you know, there's a lot of resistance to AI. I mean, this sounds very commercial, very scary, very for profit. And in reality, it's really mission driving. It's mission driving, and it's not necessarily staff replacing. And there's a lot of fear in terms of this kind of taking over our jobs and losing our jobs. In reality, the opportunity is to automate those things that are transactional, automate those things we have never gotten to that are happen to be transactional, and elevate our staff to be more strategically focused, to focus on customer insights, student insights, serving our communities, and elevate their brains to do the work and let the computers do the transactional work behind the scenes. Next slide, please. So I blew through technology. Technology is, of course, an incredibly important topic, and we could have talked about technology for 3 days in and of itself, but I'll just get into supporting the campus community. Last section, getting to more of the human side. Next slide, please. There's been a cultural transformation in higher education for some years. In fact, there's been a significant cultural transformation in the past 14 months. COVID has shifted us. Going online has shifted us. We've experienced many challenges on campus from a racial unrest and community challenging perspectives. And to think about culture that is happening to us, as well as culture that we can make happen external, right? And that's the purpose of this section. Culture has change has happened to us. Going distance learning, working offsite has changed our cultures. Next slide, please. But what's also very interesting is look at cultural transformation of higher education over a period of years, and not just the last year. In reality, it's very interesting to roll back late 1800s land grants. That was about cultural transformation. It was about providing access. It was about providing enhanced programs and using the higher education platform to transform the culture of the United States. Same with the GI Bill. Now, COVID happened to us, but the reality of what's happening here is it's always been about the who, enhanced participation in higher education. The why, programs to serve their needs. The how, programmatic enhancements, location enhancements, technological enhancements to realize that we, while providing on our mission historically, have been underserving collectively the United States needs from an educational perspective. And how do we enable ourselves to seize that opportunity, provide enhanced access, enhanced equitable outcomes, grow our enrollments, grow our footprint to be better even able to deliver on our missions than we are today. Next slide, please. So this is really an inflection point, right? Next slide, please. Perfect. We're at an inflection point. Got ahead of myself. So we're at an inflection point here. In 2020, 2021, the idea of COVID happened to us. It wasn't cultural change that we chose, but it is an inflection point to allow us to define, communicate, deliver our messages, to think about our value differentiators to the market, to think about what is our overall experience that we have provided to students and will provide to students, and which students are we serving? Are there opportunities within the current last year that we can seize in order to better provide service to students that are currently our students or students that we haven't traditionally served, which is what the last couple of slides have shown. Next slide, please. Navigating campus conversations. So next slide, please. So this has been a challenging year for a lot of reasons. COVID has been challenging. The financials have been challenging. But there's been really unrest as well, which has certainly been a challenge in and of itself. And this, frankly, isn't just in the last year. This has been happening. And campus is always a hotbed of conversations, heated dialogues. And given the last year and given the return to campus for the fall, actually, this is a concept we've been tracking for some time. We have some advice and considerations for you to consider. Next slide, please. How to best respond, how to best manage those conversations as they happen. So thinking about administrators, you know, really engaging in managing the conversations versus letting them happen to us. Having upfront coordination and planning to make sure we don't disrupt free expression. To embrace the conversations, but to have a plan in place. Next slide, please. To have a philosophy of rights and responsibilities, to make sure that we ourselves are, again, positioned to rapidly disseminate information, interact with the media, and have just a general plan to enable that expression to happen on campus and to allow ourselves to feed into our cultural beliefs as campuses, institutions, while supporting the dialogue that needs to happen. Okay. Next slide, please. This last section covers a lot of topics. It's a little bit maybe all over the place, but I hope that everything is hitting home with you all in terms of important topics. I'll quickly cover this section on mental health, supporting students in mental health. This has been a challenge in higher education for years. Next slide, please. And in fact, it's been a significant challenge over the last year. And just a quick stat here, from 2009 to 15, counselor visits increased by 30% in general, when enrollment only increased by 6%. So the idea of the fear of missing out and the challenges amongst our youth from a mental health perspective has been significant, period. Add COVID, definitely. And thinking about a role within our institutions to support them as adults, and frankly, to support our institutions as we serve our mission. This, of course, is about serving our mission, serving our students, but the last bullet's important. To improve student mental health enhances retention, enhances graduation rates, ergo, enhancing our mission. The next slide, please. It's really important to think about ways in which we can support mental health in terms of on-campus issues, how we currently do so, how there are currently opportunities to do so. And this is just a few examples of some other institutions that have invested in a variety of ways to enhance their health within their campuses. Clearly, a benchmarking is an opportunity to think about ways that we can do so as well. Next slide, please. Last topic in my sprint through the many, filling talent gaps in the future of work. Next slide, please. We have truly an opportunity here within higher education, and frankly, across the United States, in the government sector, in the public sector, in the commercial sector, there's just a march for talent, right? A challenge in terms of finding out who will be best part of our workforce. And the overarching question in this article that we published is, who is your workforce today? Who is your workforce tomorrow? Where are they located? And what populations will be part of that cohort? There are generation-specific styles of recruiting. For example, this is an example on screen. How do you recruit Gen Z? How do you retain Gen Z? Which is very different than recruiting and retaining other generations. Next slide, please. And of course, there's a challenge of working remotely, and it adds a series of questions to all of us and to every organization, company, and institution today, thinking about where should our people sit? A very basic question. Many institutions are deciding, for example, those institutions that are in areas that are geographically underpopulated, do we want to continue requiring our people to be in our immediate locale? Or we're seeing institutions, higher ed, healthcare, et cetera, say, we're going to allow our back offices to be from anywhere. Clearly, that causes some challenges, but some opportunities to get the best talent. So thinking about ways that we carve out our culture, set expectations as we return to campus. Next slide, please. And this, of course, is not just about strategy. It's about all getting in the weeds, how this feeds into job descriptions, expectations on site. It's including inclusive wording to get the best candidates. And of course, it's about creating programs in place to retain our talent. It will be harder and harder in this market to retain the best talent. There are so many opportunities out there, especially as this economy heats up, returning people to the workforce. So next slide, please. I'll just sum up here with the road ahead. If you can go to the next slide, please. I've said a lot. It's hard in this forum to read faces and to see to what extent this hits home. We've covered a lot of topics, and I've done so at a probably a pretty rapid pace, maybe too rapid of a pace, but there was a lot that I wanted to get through in this initial conversation. There's a lot that we can talk about in subsequent conversations. And I thought I would just slow down and give you one slide to sum up. This one slide is meant to sum up from a really a leadership perspective, a governance perspective, to say, what are the things that we should be truly thinking about as organizations? You just went through 60 odd slides, Matt. What should we really be thinking about? And what are institutions investing in today as a result of where they are? 9 things on the left, thinking about COVID assessment and lessons learned. What did we learn? We hope this is once in a lifetime. How should we be prepared for the future? Return to campus part 1, return to campus part 2, how do we do this differently? Ongoing response monitoring and communications. This effectively was a real-time test of our business continuity plans. How do we do? How do we monitor this on a going forward basis? Clearly, institutions are learning about ERM and what we had on our risk register and what we didn't. Reserves planning. How much should we have from reserves when, if something like this were to happen again, or something, anything were to happen again? How future ready are we really? What do we have set aside for some challenges in the future? What do we have set aside for investment? Are we truly efficient as an organization? There's been some silver linings, as I mentioned, over the past year. We have improved some efficiencies, but have we truly done it to the degree that we could now that we can take a second look at things? Many institutions have put off investments in IT and systems optimization in cybersecurity, and they're realizing these things that we put off for too long pre-pandemic, now that we're getting to this place where over the last year, we truly haven't invested in these areas, we're seeing an increase of interest in spending in these areas to really do a catch up in underinvestment for multiple years. Cost and revenue modeling, I mentioned, we're seeing an increased in uptick in that to think about what is our true operating model, where are we making money, where are we losing money, where are there opportunities? And really, it's about striking the balance, downside risk and upside opportunity. You know, thinking about what is our mission as an organization, how we deployed our resources traditionally, where are we positioned within the higher education landscape? It's very interesting. We knew where we were. This is the higher education landscape. We knew where we were historically, but higher education is moving. Where are we going to be in the future? Are we in the same spot or should we be modified? It's a really great conversation to think about ourselves. And again, going from 19 to 22 to 23 and maybe beyond. Thinking about customer strategies, product strategies, thinking about ourselves not just as mission delivery organizations, but also in terms of consumer-oriented organizations. Doing models. Of course, over the last year, many did models and iterated on their budgets. But thinking about now, there's a lot of unknowns. How do we model that? How do we make investments in transactions to achieve our opportunities within our mission? So I will go next slide, please. So I will defer to Chair Carter if there's any opportunity within timing here for Q&A. I think I've used up the bulk of the allotted time. I'm happy to have a conversation. I'm also happy to dialogue in the future. But I really do thank Chair Carter and the committee for the opportunity to talk about the things that we're seeing in the industry. I hope that, as your internal auditor mentioned, this was exciting and fascinating. We're finding this to be exciting and fascinating about the opportunities that are out there to serve mission and to transform ourselves as higher education. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was incredibly valuable. I know we changed some emails back and forth trying to figure out exactly what to do and kind of thought maybe showing the menu of possibilities might be a good way to start. And we can kind of talk offline about what areas we would like to dig deeper into going in the future. And you were right on the dot almost at 45 minutes, but I inherited some time. So we do have time for some questions here. So if there are members of the committee or members of the board, presidents, anybody that has any questions or comments to add. Do I see anybody? Anybody questions, comments? Anybody up north? Regent Carvalho?
Well, as I said, as you said, this was very valuable, and I really appreciate the information that was shared with us at such a rapid pace. There's, I think we have some homework to do to catch up to where you are with this. So thank you, Chair Carter, for bringing this to the committee and to the board today. And thank you for sharing the deck with us. Thank you.
Did you have something else, Regional Carlo?
Thank you, Chair Carter. Just that I will be glad to have the deck. And thank you, Matt. It was really interesting. It was some of the conversations I had yesterday with one of the institution CFOs. I mean, we have a lot of challenges ahead, and you've really laid it out where they are. And now it's a matter of really studying it and seeing where we're going to go. I mean, there's a lot of great things ahead, but we got to know what we're doing too. So a lot of challenges, a lot of opportunities. So looking forward to future discussions.
Fantastic. Any, sorry?
And thank you, Regent Carter, for bringing it to our attention. This was really valuable.
Well, absolutely. Now, this is a great kind of value add to what Grant Thornton can offer. So I'm very pleased that they have offered this in the last contract, and we've got this, and we have the opportunity to bring back hopefully more sessions. I'm not sure what that number is, but we can bring back some more sessions as well. Any other discussion? Seeing none, thank you again so much. That was great. We'll move on to
thank you, Chair Carter.
We'll move on to item number 11, new business. Is there any new business? Hearing none, seeing none, we'll move on to item number 12, public comment. Do we have any public comment in Las Vegas? Hearing none, seeing none, do we have any public comment in Reno?
There is no public comment in Reno.
And this meeting is adjourned.